Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we'll start with politics. Dan Wolf's out, sort of. Scott Brown's out, definitely. So who's in for governor for 2014? You like being locked away quietly in your office? Or are you the Michael Bloomberg sit in the middle of the room type? We'll explore the pros and cons of the open office. On Open Mic, Gene Rivers was in D.C. for the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. He'll give us his firsthand take. Then it's a tale of two reverends. Reverend Irene Monroe joins Reverend Rivers to debate, is the gay civil rights struggle of the 21st century the equivalent of the black struggle of the 20th? Then we simultaneously celebrate the history and mourn the virtual demise of the drive-in movie as a staple of America's summers. Garen Daly describes the future. We'll ask you to retell the past. That's all next on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. Marjorie Egan is off. She will be back tomorrow. Sitting in, she of the Innovation Hub. That'd be Kara Miller. Hi, Kara.
Hi.
We ever done this? We've done this together?
No.
I didn't think
so. I mean, I've been on the show, but I've not co-hosted with
you. A little nervous, I have to admit.
I would be.
We'll make. Okay, we're going to start with politics. Democratic candidates for governor in Massachusetts come and go. Republicans just go. Will Charlie Baker break the snide? 12 Boston mayoral wannabes are a month away from becoming two. Are any of the dozen breaking through? Then we'll explore what the president should be doing in Syria and Egypt. And while we're at it, we'll see if Scott Brown's going to run for president. Here to go through all this with us are political strategist of the Democratic side, Michael Goldman of Goldman & Associates. Hey, Michael.
Pleasure.
And Joe Malone, the former Republican state treasurer. How are you, Joe?
Excellent. Great to be here.
Pleasure
great
for you,
to
too.
Be here. Yes,
of
Plymouth Rock Financial, as long as
Excuse me.
I don't want people to think I'm retired. You
I
know?
Assume it was so obvious. Yeah, we didn't even need saying.
Can I talk to you about my policy?
Bring it on, baby. Bring it on.
So I'm going to launch into a question here. Two really interesting things going on. One is Scott Brown seems to be out of this governor's race. The other question is Charlie Baker in? But first, Scott Brown. A great tweet from Mike Murphy, the Republican strategist, who said that if Scott Brown is thinking about national office, going to Iowa, this is a quote, madness, the Iowa Republican caucus would, quote, eat him alive. So, Michael Goldman, what's going on with Scott Brown before we get to Charlie Baker?
Well, I like Mike, and he's damn right accurate here. The only thing funnier than that would be if Mitt Romney decided he was going to run again for the nomination for president. He's the only guy that have less of a chance than Scott Brown. Yes, in part because of Romney. I think that's true. But because Iowa is a brutal place, if you take a look at who won there, Rick Santorum beat Ron Paul. I mean, we're not talking about mainstream Republicans like Joe Malone. And you've got, of course, the whole process. Michelle Bachmann won the famous Iowa picnic, you remember.
Straw poll
picnic. And the problem is when you have good candidates, and I'm talking about guys like Chris Christie and Jeb Bush and others who could eventually actually be winning candidates who could actually win an election – they get killed in the Iowa process, and I don't know what the party can do to change that. And Scott Brown is just not going to be somebody who plays it.
By the way, I've won a picnic or two myself. You know, speaking of Scott Brown, before we get to you, Joe, he guest hosted the O'Reilly Factor on Friday. He's talking about how divided the country is and sounding a little like he's delivering a stump speech. Listen.
I believe the people are fed up. They're tired of the divisiveness, tired of our elected officials putting their personal political interests ahead of our country's interests. People are looking for us to band together and come up with a plan to rescue our country and bring us all forward as Americans first. We can't do it if we stay divided.
Who can disagree with that? So is this a serious thing? Or he says, you know, Gail, who also, in full disclosure, works at GBH part-time on the television side, his wife, obviously, Gail Huff. Was this just a visit to see her relatives and a little teasing of the media, or is this a real deal?
Well, you know, I think some people who have had a taste of national limelight have a hard time stepping away from that and simply going to work at a law office every day. And I think this is
or an insurance company, is that what you mean?
Or it's not an insurance company, it's a wealth management company.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
But so I think this is part of his way of keeping himself in the limelight and maybe making himself a player behind the scenes in the next presidential election, but basically trying to build up some capital. Now, to dovetail on what Michael said, not only are you dealing with the aftermath of Romney, so if you're from Massachusetts, it's not great, but if you look at Rudy Giuliani, a moderate, if you look at where—
You were a Giuliani supporter, were you not?
I was, yeah. And he couldn't get off first base. It kept on being, and he was an American hero.
Pro-choice, being pro-choice and pro-gay in a Republican primary is not a great asset.
Absolutely. So here you have now Scott Brown saying, well, I'm going to be the moderate in this race. There's no slice of the pie for a moderate in the in the Republican primary.
Well, can I challenge that just for one second? I'm not talking about his underlying policies, but many hardcore conservative Republicans think Chris Christie almost committed treason prior to last year's presidential election when he literally and figuratively was embracing the president of the United States. And a lot of people think it helped propel Barack Obama to re-election. Christie's a star in the party.
Well, let me add to that, too, that you've seen Chris Christie say that we shouldn't have gay conversion therapy. So, I mean, I wonder if there's a place in the party for Chris Christie come the Iowa straw poll.
That's the point. Chris Christie hasn't won anything yet. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe he proves to be the guy who can do it, but right now he's in the same boat that Giuliani was leading into the election 6 years ago, you know, where he was leading the pack among Republicans.
But then when it went
mm-hmm. Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, he was gone.
I want to add here, and I think people are going to think I'm joking, but I'm not. I do some stuff on a radio station in New Hampshire regularly, and there's all kinds of talk about him taking on the current
Gene Shaheen.
Him meaning Scott Brown.
Scott Brown, and he said that his family came from— If Gail's family came from Iowa, luckily for him, his family came from New Hampshire. And I think that it's an interesting thing that Joe said. Some people cannot not be on the center stage. Once you've got it, it's
shocking in politics.
Yeah,
is there in New Hampshire, though? Because, I mean, you saw Romney saying, I vacationed in New Hampshire. That's pretty good, right? I mean, is this enough to give him a shot in New Hampshire, Scott Brown?
The cumulative effect here of maybe I'll run in New Hampshire, maybe I'll run the special election that Markey ultimately won, maybe I'll run for governor, maybe I'll run for president. It's all more a case of I'm shopping around to find some place to continue to be celebrity Scott Brown, as opposed to I am passionate about trying to solve problems or trying to advance the cause for people in a particular place at this given time.
Okay,
it
scares me when he's so right.
Let's come back to Massachusetts for a second. We started this conversation with Scott Brown last week on Dan Ray's radio show, saying I am not doing the governor thing. I don't know what to do in the future. The conventional wisdom that totally clears the field for Charlie Baker. Charlie will be with us tomorrow at 1:00, like he is every Tuesday. He has said repeatedly he will decide whether he's running or not come Labor Day, which obviously is a week away. What's he going to do with Joe Malone?
I mean, I'm hearing that he is going to announce that he'll be running for governor, and that seems to be the body language that exists out there. But, you know, who knows?
Is that a good choice for the Republican Party, Charlie Baker?
Yeah, I think for the Republican Party, it's the best choice they could come up with. I think even better than Scott Brown. However, time will tell, given that Massachusetts now is a very different place, even when it was, the victory situation for Romney or going back to the well days when I was in office. It's changed quite a bit, and you saw it where a lot of people thought that DeVal Patrick was vulnerable 3 years ago, and when all was said and done, you know,
Against Charlie Baker, he won pretty handily.
Yeah, he won pretty handily.
I
don't think there's any doubt that everyone has known for months that Charlie Baker is going to run. And I love the fact he comes on and says, I haven't made up my mind. But he has done everything necessary to get ready for this race. And I think he learned from the last race. I think he is desperate to show that was an anomaly. And I think it'll be a great race. I think you guys have a blast with this race.
Michael Goldman, I just have a question about Scott Brown saying, I'm not going to run, and then sort of maybe passing the torch to Charlie Baker. One of the things he said to Dan Ray when he said, I'm not running, is something to the effect of, well, everybody knows that Charlie Baker is no Mr. Personality. I mean, is that some sort of schoolyard politics? What's going on here?
And I thought it was also interesting to add to that is the number of people say, wouldn't it be great if there was a primary between Charlie Baker and Gomez? Now, the point is that he has enemies out there, people who are unhappy.
Who's he?
Charlie Baker in the party. And there are people who think that if he wins, Republicans who think if he wins, they don't win. So I'm not sure it's going to be...
If he wins the primary? Primary, if he wins
right,
the general. Okay.
The primary, or the general. I mean, it's not as though he... The Republican Party, despite what we think, has one face, is what I guess what I'm saying.
Let me just say, but I want to get Michael Goldman, your assessment of the power of a Baker candidacy. And here's my analysis. Beyond the fact that I think he was a pretty good candidate, despite what people said, running against an incredible campaigner 3 years ago, meaning Deval Patrick. Charlie, I think, as we talked to him every Tuesday on the air, I think he's gotten better, more relaxed, all that sort of thing. Secondly, I was talking to Kara about this before the show, or thirdly, Mitt Romney's strongest calling card, I thought, in 2002 was this Gang of Three thing. Do you really want the Senate controlled by Democrats, the House controlled by Democrats? Don't you want a little check? When we're down to three Republicans out of 39 in the state Senate, I think that argument is unbelievably powerful. If you're a big-time Democrat, you're not voting for Baker. If you're a fence-sitter, that's a pretty powerful argument, isn't it?
It's the one I would use if he were my client, certainly. But I think that the problem that Charlie Baker has is, despite the fact he does well on this show, and I hear him weekly, and I think he's articulate, I think campaigning, as Joe Malone will say, having been out there, is a different thing. I think that what we saw in that campaign, in the end, is what you're going to get here, and that is a guy who, quite frankly, doesn't like to have pushback, doesn't like when people question him, doesn't like when anyone questions either his substance or his motives. And I don't think that's
sort of like Deval Patrick in the first year in office, isn't it?
Exactly. But not the Deval Patrick who ran for re-election.
Now, I'll give you a little gem here that I'm hearing more and more often these days, is that there is an independent candidate who will be very credible, and he won't self-fund his race, but he will put significant amount of money in. I can't give
but
you
come
the
on.
Name. I can't give
Say
you the name.
Say his name backwards
I
or her name backwards.
No,
I mean, come on.
Yeah,
wait,
no.
An independent candidate who's Republican-leaning, which means the end of the – I mean, it's sort of like Cahill Part 2 for Baker?
Well, I asked that question. Where does this guy come from? He's given to Democrats. He's given to Republicans. So he's not someone who you can sort of say he's left the Republican Party. But, it will be interesting because a three-way race changes the
Everything.
Dynamic completely. Right.
Joe Malone, former Republican state treasurer, let me ask you Jim's question again about this idea of running against this Democratic establishment. Obviously, it's been done in Massachusetts before. Bill Weld did it. I mean, it's Mitt Romney did it. It's been done.
Joe Malone did it.
Joe Malone did it. But I wonder if the nature of the National Republican Party has changed in such a way that it's almost become something really negative to associate yourself with the Republican Party.
Great point, Kara. Number one, the brand Republican, unfortunately, if you're Charlie Baker, rubs off on you from
yeah,
the Washington
the brand,
scene.
Right.
But number two, the Obama coalition, which is African Americans, it's Hispanics, it's women and young voters, you need to find a way to crack that. And in 1990, when I ran for treasurer, it was a different coalition of Massachusetts Democrats, one that they put together. But you really had to do it in such a personal way that you worked every single day from morning till night, finding out who the key person was in town X and going and meeting with them, and then finding that you could tap into those networks. So I can remember Bill Weld saying, how are you doing so well in Brockton? I mentioned about five names, and they all had their own spheres of influence, and that's the way you do it. That's why with the Gomez thing, I'm seeing him in all of these Republican neighborhoods or communities like Cohasset and so forth, as opposed to why isn't he in Lawrence and Lynn and Waltham in place meeting with Hispanic leaders there and saying, look, I'm a different kind of Republican, and I want to spend an hour with you to convince you of that fact. So that's what has to be done. And Charlie, learning from his last race, perhaps is going to figure out how to do that.
Do you worry that it's an old line, but I've used it 1,000 times. Why not 1,001? If Baker decides not to do this, isn't it sort of RIP for the GOP in this state? We just lived through this Markey race where, no disrespect intended to the three men who ran on the Republican side, including the nominee, Gabriel Gomez, who I think did a decent job for first-time candidate. If you got to go to the second tier yet again for a major statewide race, there's a pretty strong message there. Is there not? Well doesn't want to run. Brown doesn't want to run. Sure. Baker doesn't want to run. Essentially, the stars of the party.
Well, one of two things. Either he doesn't run or he runs and loses. The Republican Party needs a major intervention because, unfortunately, it's It's a small circle of friends. It's a party of 11% of the overall electorate, and a small group of people are clinging on to power. They don't want to let it go. They want to be kingmakers. But when all is said and done, they don't elect anybody, so they're not kingmakers. And we found the same thing back in 1987 when I became director of the party. Ray Shammy was chairman. It has to be about inclusion. These people are about exclusion, and that's what's killing them.
But here's the big problem, and Joe's sort of gotten on the edge of it. The reality is inside even Massachusetts, there are people who believe the reason that the Republicans are where they are is because they haven't gone far enough to the right. They believe that in the National Party too. If you listen to the Ted Cruz's and the Rand Paul's, they say it was because we elected moderates like McCain and Romney that we lost in the end. And the way to build a party is to wipe out the Joe Malones, with all due respect, and to start from scratch and just build a right party that we can, again, run against the Democrats.
By the way, I'm glad you didn't presume I've already been wiped out. You know?
Michael Goldman, last thing on the gubernatorial front, and then we're going to move to the city. Martha Coakley, there was a story before July 4th saying, or whenever her birthday was, it was a birthday barbecue. She's going to announce at her barbecue during the summer. She didn't announce. You know, while everybody says, when is Charlie Baker going to do it? At least Baker has said repeatedly, by Labor Day, you'll hear from me yes or no. Where is Martha Coakley in this race?
And I'm going to piggyback onto that. What do you make of Juliette Kayyem, the former Globe columnist, jumping into the race with some pretty professional-looking videos and...
Well, I think that both of those things are connected. I think initially I understood that Kayyem wasn't going to run if Martha did. She just felt she couldn't wait any longer. So that plays into your piece, Jim. I think the two names that are still out there are a client of mine, Michael Capuano, and Martha Coakley. They changed the dynamic of that race as much as Baker not running does. And because now you have a whole group of people who no one's ever voted for before. I think both of them will be making the decision within, I would say, 10 days.
Is Coakley running?
I go back and forth, Jim. Seriously. I thought she wasn't, then I was absolutely sure she was. Now I'm not sure. I feel the same way about
Michael. How about your client, Capuano? See, my take on the Capuano thing, as soon as Joe Cardatone, his successor, the Somerville mayor, started saying, I'm thinking of running for governor, the message it conveyed to me is that his predecessor had told him, I'm not running for
governor.
That's
not correct. I can tell you that's absolutely not correct. But it's a good theory, but it's not true.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
You know, one of the things that occurred should play into this is Michael was supposed to go with the
Capuano
with members of the congressional delegation to an aspirin meeting in Africa, a very big think meeting, and he didn't go. So my sense is he's looking at it as hard as one can look at it. You don't cancel a trip like that unless you're really thinking.
Yeah, but wait, he went to the state Democratic convention. They said he was there in a polo shirt with no literature, and no signs,
because
no volunteers.
Ultimately, in the end, Michael Capuano has and Martha Coakley have advantages other candidates don't. If you're Dean Wolf, and even if you're Steve Grossman, you got to work this. If Michael Capuano or Martha Coakley runs, they have natural organizations, fundraising that clicks into gear. Within a month, they've caught up.
So a quick point on Coakley, though. She rushes into the defense of the DA from Middlesex County in this Jared Rennie
worked
case.
For her. Worked
but,
with her.
But I'm thinking, why do you want to do that? If you're running for governor, either you're not straightened out your head as a gubernatorial candidate, just as...
Well, how about the fact that after that, though, she leads the charge in the last few days about trying to ferret out EBT fraud, which I'm not saying she doesn't care about it, but one would argue that's also a wonderful message for moderate voters. We got to move to the city. Speaking of your clients, Walsh is one of your clients,
Marty
correct?
Marty Walsh.
I only want to spend a minute on this, you two. The conventional wisdom was it's all ground game, it's this. We are now, less than a month away from the runoff, which will narrow the dozen down to two. I think it's September 24th.
Correct.
There is a virtual dead heat. These pollsters like to say there's a second. There's no second tier. Essentially, a first tier and a first and a half tier is what it is. How does, forget your candidate for a second, how does anybody break away from the pack here in the next 20 some days?
Well, one thing is money and media. You're going to see the candidates going
up. So Dan Conley, the DA, should be in good shape.
Well,
on that
except
front,
that
yes?
You have to have a field too. It's the candidates who have money and a field. And right now, two of the candidates fall into that category. Marty Walsh and John Conley. Both of them have the money to be up on TV and the ability to get out a vote. Having one piece of that puzzle, whether it's just a field or just money, doesn't play. it's going to be very hard for anyone, with all due respect, to break back in. I will say this to you, that the field race among a lot of the candidates, including Rob Consalvo, including to a lesser degree Mike Ross, they got pretty good operations. The real question is can they compete with the guys with the bucks?
Michael Goldman, I mean, is this a specialist election? I mean, you go out on the street in Boston, stop 20 people and ask them how many mayoral candidates they can name? Zero. You're right. Holding up zero.
Right.
I mean, then like Jim was saying, this is sort of a real specialist. Can you get out a few labor people?
22,000 to 24,000 people wins the race. Nobody's base is large enough to get out 24,000 votes.
That's crazy.
So you need to get your base, whether it's Hyde Park for Consalvo or Dorchester for Marty Walsh or West Roxbury for Connolly, and then grow it. And the two people who are in the lead have figured out a way, at least so far, to grow their base. It's fascinating.
Well, the lead is a
well, except
an odd
it's a
choice of
you know
12% and 11% is not
except,
exactly.
Except you said it perfectly. The truth is, no one else is in double digits. And remember, the vote's not going to be broken up by
Agreed.
Seven or eight candidates.
Okay, here's the quiz for you.
Spent for 20,000 votes. That's okay, just that kind
and
of
following up
line.
On what Kara Miller just asked, Joe. Would you like a GBH mug?
I would love it.
Okay, if you can name nine of the 12 candidates running for mayor in Boston, I'll try to find you a GBH mug. Go ahead.
You want me to jump in? Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
So you got two Connollys.
Yeah.
You got Walsh.
Yeah.
You got Gola Ritchie.
That's okay. Pretty impressive. It's
all
five.
Right. Consalvo.
Six.
Six. You got.
I gave you one.
Yeah, he's not getting a mug.
Wait a minute. Hold on a second. You have Yancey.
That's seven.
You have.
This is trouble.
Let's see here. He's
I'm sorry.
Charades.
Time's up.
Yeah.
I'm trying to help. Yeah,
that was pretty good.
It was good enough. We'll give you like a pencil or
Thank
something
you.
Yeah, from.
Yeah,
from
I'll take the what do you call those packs they give you? The bags there. The
party pack.
No, it's a bag. Tote
Family
bag. A
tote bag.
Bag.
We'll see what we can do.
Yeah.
For
you know,
GBH made tote bags famous. Right?
I'm going to just digress here, and I've told you this story before.
Go
but
ahead.
Way back, I was on your TV show.
Yes, you were.
And
Kara
I
Miller.
Was did a quiz, and you said if you win this quiz, you can get a mug.
I lied to
you.
Me too.
Right.
Yeah. Lied
no, you
to
did
me
not.
Too. Never got
no,
the deal.
You didn't.
I'm
okay,
still
you
waiting
said
for
you can get a mug, and then at the end, I said I'd like a mug, and you said I don't actually have one. I have this dirty one here that has my coffee, and
I emailed you for your address. You never emailed me.
Not and I said I will take that dirty mug. I will wash it out.
Okay.
And do I still
so
have it at home? I do.
Kara, thank God, so we finally called him on the mugs that he owes thousands of people.
That's right.
And you know,
right.
I was going to make.
I hope you don't run for anything because they're all going to want theirs anyway.
Okay, let's move to national. Colin Powell, who you don't hear much from these days, was on Face the Nation yesterday. Obviously, in the context of the 50th anniversary this week of the March of Washington, he told fellow Republicans they need to work harder to get people of color into their party. Here he is.
You say you want to reach out. You say you want to have a new message. You say you want to see if you can bring some of these voters to the Republican side. This is not the way to do it. The way to do it is to make it easier for them to vote and then give them something to vote for that they can believe in.
Michael Goldman, you know, we're talking about this divide. We were talking about before with Joe Mullen, this divide in the Republican Party. It's become a whiter party, a more southern party. I was looking at the numbers before I came down here. There are groups. Now, everybody knows that Hispanics and blacks tend to vote overwhelmingly for Democrats. But there are groups, Asian Americans, Jews. By all rights, they should be voting for Republicans, right? They tend to be married in higher numbers. They tend to have higher incomes. 75% of Asian Americans in the last election voted for Barack Obama, 70% of Jews. How can you put a coalition together if you are losing all minorities?
Well, you made one mistake. The truth is that Hispanics should be voting Republican because if you look at the two social issues they care most about, as Catholics, it is gay marriage, which they do not support as a group, and abortion, which they don't support.
Well, you've also got immigration reform,
well,
which
that's what
is a
kills
problem.
Them. If they could have figured, that was the brilliance, and I use this term not lightly when I talk about George W. Bush, but the brilliance of Karl Rove and George W. Bush in 2004, the highest percentage of Hispanics voting for Republicans occurred in 2004 when they ran and barely beat John Kerry because they had a sensible, reasonable outreach to Hispanics in terms of
well, he also had a long history in Texas.
Yeah, exactly. Where, he spoke Spanish. His brother's married to a Hispanic girl. The point is the party veered off in 2005 and went down a road which crushed Mitt Romney. They went from 46% of the Hispanic vote in 2004 to 21%.
And 29, but who's counting? No, 71 to 29 amongst Latinos. No, it was a ridiculous spread. But how do they fix this, Joma? Okay, hey, meaning your party. You've been pretty honest in terms of self-criticism.
I think there was sort of a perfect storm in the sense that you had these conservative talk show hosts who just got on the immigration thing and made it such a mean-spirited issue, number one. Number two, Mitt Romney, you know, I always thought when I was a candidate, in my mind I had, or an interview like this, I had an audience I was talking to that were basically people I grew up with in Waltham. I think in Mitt Romney's case, he was talking to a boardroom on Wall Street or a boardroom over at Bain, and he really wasn't talking about middle to lower class aspirations and the American dream. And so as a result, a lot of people felt like the Republican Party wasn't even welcoming them in. Then you have the 47% gaffe, you know, that these people, we can't even talk to them because they're all on the government dole. So that kept reinforcing. Then you add to it the self-deportation with Hispanic voters, and you add it all up, and Mitt Romney was a disaster in terms of broadening the party.
I want to go back to you.
But I just want to finish this, and that is the next presidential candidate on the Republican side could come along and with a still flat economy, he could turn that all around, or she could turn that all around very quickly. It remains to be seen.
Well, simple matter, before you continue, one of the things I'm not clear about, and Joe, maybe you know, maybe one of the other two of you know, Karen Miller or Michael Goldman. On Wednesday, Barack Obama is speaking at a commemoration, Lincoln Memorial. Obviously, that's the actual day, the 50th anniversary. He's being joined by Presidents Carter and Clinton. Why is George Bush, the younger, obviously George Bush, the elder, is not, his health is not. Why is the younger George Bush, particularly in light of the history, why is he not at this event on Wednesday? Do you know?
I don't know, but he did have he had his health problem, too. Mm-hmm. Remember?
Well, that's a good point. Yeah.
Maybe that is it.
I don't know.
But, I want to go back to Joe's point, and this isn't to be unfair to the Republicans. I don't mean this to sound that way. But the reality is that when Michael Dukakis ran in 1988, if he was on the air right now and you said to him, what was the number one question you were asked, Michael, when you ran nationally? It was, you're Greek. What does that mean? Now, around here, we have a ton of Greeks. When Giuliani and I worked for Cuomo, the father, not the son, we wanted him to run as the candidate in 88. And he said, I can't win as an Italian in this country because huge swaths of the country don't even know what Italians are and are afraid of us. And I think Giuliani bumped into that, even as you say, a hero after 9/11. I still think that there is still inside that party this sort of aversion, not totally, Joe, and I understand that, but in huge swaths of the country where they just don't deal with ethnics of any type.
Yeah, you know what? I'm not sure of that, because once you get beyond Iowa, and you can strategically say,
South Carolina?
Well, now you come to New Hampshire. If you can win New Hampshire, then you can weather a loss in South Carolina and then move into places like Florida, where they understand what an Italian is, or, you know.
Joe Malone, former Republican state treasurer, I question whether, when you say if you can get beyond Iowa and you get to New Hampshire, I mean, that's a kind of a big if. You talked before about talk show hosts sort of, you know, coming from the right and beating up on moderates. But it is more than just talk show hosts. You look at Lindsey Graham, a conservative from South Carolina, who is really, really worried about a primary opponent on his right. Trying to go against him. He was asked by the president to go visit Egypt, obviously in turmoil. And this is what people called him back in South Carolina, conservatives, that he's a community organizer for the Muslim Brotherhood. He has to spend all his time worrying about how to fend those people off. This is not just talk show hosts.
The same thing's going on in the Kentucky race, too. You know, and
with Mitch McConnell, you're talking about.
Yeah, with Mitch McConnell, where he is now being challenged in a primary from the right. So the point is, the Republican Party is now at this crossroad here, and if people from the moderate side of that party don't go and vote for a conservative who is reasonable, not a moderate that Scott Brown's painting himself in, because I think his death knell will be the ads he was running saying I was the deciding vote for Dodd-Frank. So I think he's way too far to the left. But if you have somebody, Jeb Bush, if he didn't have the brother and father having already served, he would be a very,
other
very
than
strong
the fact
candidate.
That his brother and his father.
But honestly, I mean, I think there's just the fatigue of Bush.
But you know,
I
got to move
Lincoln,
on here for a second.
Because Mrs. Lincoln, how'd you like to play?
It seems to me that one of the ways that there's some hope on the Republican side on this issue is that there may be other issues in which the Democrats come in a distant second. We have a situation in Syria where Karen and I were discussing this before. The President of the United States said the red line is chemical weapons. They're now chemical weapons. What are we going to do? Egypt is in turmoil. A democratically elected president is removed by the military. It's allegedly not a coup, and we're not sure. It seems to me what Democrats are able to say, yeah, he got bin Laden, and which is huge, and Republicans are able to say he got bin Laden, but it's pretty clear these Democrats have no idea how to solidify our role in the world. We have no credibility anymore, particularly in the exploding Middle East. How does a Democrat respond to that?
Well, I think that what they're trying to do, and I don't disagree with that premise, by the way. I think it's a very fair premise that you laid out. I think that part of the problem is this administration understands that it does not have either the support inside the country or the support around the world to go in by itself anywhere. If they cannot put a coalition together, they can't go into Egypt. If they can't put a coalition together, they can't go into Syria. It doesn't. It reminds me of
Hungary.
So George
Bush knew what he was doing with these coalitions
then.
Is that what you're saying?
Ultimately, this is not unlike when I was a kid in Hungary, when the Russians went into Hungary in 1956, and people said to Eisenhower, the great hero of World War II, why aren't we going in? And he said, we can't go everywhere. And the real question, and you've asked, is did he put a line down, and will anybody support boots on the ground, American kids dying in Syria or dying in Egypt? And I don't think that any poll shows they do.
I was going to say, when you look at the polling, it is.
What do you do?
And you look at the difference between polling when Syria's used chemical weapons and they haven't. People couldn't care less whether they've used chemical weapons.
I see it differently here, and that is, I think this administration has gotten around to saying, what is in our best interest, and hell with everything else, because the Middle East is such a crazy place. The last thing we want to do is end up with one side saying America is to blame, and now you got more terrorism problems. So, for example, take with Egypt. They say, we don't want the Muslim Brotherhood here. And we're going to make lip service that, oh, where this is this a coup or isn't it a coup? Well, you know what? They didn't do anything to help the Brotherhood, and they shouldn't have. That would have been a disaster for Israel.
So what does Barack Obama say? If Assad is overthrown in Syria at some point, and there are to be democratic elections, what does Barack Obama say, or a democratic president say, when the question is, I know you want a democratic election, but if the people of Syria elect somebody who you're not crazy about, sort of like Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood, are you not going to support them when the military overthrows them? We're putting ourselves in a pretty tough spot.
Which is why there was a New York Times piece yesterday that said, we'll help the rebels just enough to keep this battle going. If it goes 10, 15 years, all the better. Basically, let them keep engaged with each other, keep Assad in there, keep them basically not looking at America as the enemy, but at each other. Because on the one hand, you have Al-Qaeda, and on the other hand, you have Assad. Who do you want to win?
I think you might have more hands than that in
yeah,
this,
exactly,
in this fight.
Right.
And I wonder, too, this is so complicated. If it becomes a proxy war, right?
No,
because
you've
got Russia
us,
and China
right?
saying,
you know,
here you go, Assad,
you know,
Assad,
you know who
weapons.
Had the right answer?
Absolutely.
The guy who had the right answer, you get a shock when I say it. Ronald Reagan in 1982, when we lost 242 guys in Lebanon and people started saying, let's go in and bomb it, he pulled the guys out. You can't fight everywhere. We can't afford to do it. And Joe said it. The Middle East is a disaster.
Oh,
how
yeah.
the hell do you go in? How do you choose who the good guys are?
And by the way, coming off of Afghanistan and Iraq, the people of this country are
let
so...
Let me just insert in here the devil's advocate position, which is, well, okay, but you've got Iran watching all this. You've got Iran watching the president say, there's a red line, you can't cross it. Then they cross the red line and he says, well, that's serious,
okay.
but
so
we're not going to do
so
much
about
it.
So if you're sitting
it.
In the Situation Room, you say, now we got two tough choices here. One is we go spend more money and we go make the country even more war-weary by taking on this serious situation. Or through back channels, we say to Iran, don't be mistaken here. Don't right. be mistaken for one second, because we're not getting involved in that mess doesn't mean your spirit should be buoyed. If you get aggressive, we are taking you out.
Okay.
And that's
we'll
what we're
see
saving
how seriously
it
they take
I've
that.
Got to move
but
this
no,
from
right.
the sublime
right.
to the ridiculous before Malone and Goldman leave. There's another name we haven't mentioned. Obviously, we're talking about presidential leadership, whether it's foreign policy or it's civil rights, diversity. A name that is, I'm sure, high on your list of potential future presidential candidates is this guy. Here's an ad for his university. Listen, please.
We're going to teach you about business. We're going to teach you better than the business schools are going to teach you. And I went to the best business school. We're going to teach you better. It's going to be a shorter process. It's not going to involve years and years of your life. It's going to be less expensive. And I think it's going to be a better education.
I was hoping to go to summer school at Trump University, but I was busy most of this summer. Now, that is an ad. He's being sued by $40 million by the Attorney General of New York State. But a serious question here. The new darling of the Republican Party is Ted Cruz, the Tea Party senator from Texas. It turns out we found out recently, I guess a lot of people knew I didn't, he was actually born in Canada. And it turns out that birthers like Trump are being asked questions. Well, wait a second. If you believe that Barack Obama was born in Kenya, which he apparently wasn't, and he's as a result, he would be disqualified, according to you, for running for president. Ted Cruz admits he was born in Canada. How can he run for president? What do they do here, Joe Malone?
Well, supposedly he's got all the documentation that says his mother was American.
Yeah,
and she
so was Barack Obama's.
Yeah, but no. And there's a different situation.
What is the different
Barack,
situation?
According to the thing, he didn't have the birth certificate. He had falsified certificate. He's showing all the data, right?
But the Donald Trumps are in a pretty tough spot on this one, are they not?
But that goes to the point, that back to Charlie Baker, where we started this conversation.
I can't wait to hear this segue.
You get all this baggage from all this craziness from the Republican Party at the national level.
I have a birth certificate that demonstrates Charlie Baker was born in the United States.
Yeah, he's born here. I don't believe that's true. He's good.
Let him provide the documentation, right?
He's legit.
I think you're overlooking the obvious solution that Donald Trump is going to advocate here. Annex Canada. And then, Ted Cruz
Absolutely.
Is born in America.
Can you imagine, though, on a note of seriousness, one of the great problems we have in this country is this idea of these, you know, universities who offer and make promises that, and it's not just Trump, that steal money from a lot of people. And we have government money going to that
Martha
university.
Martha Coakley's going after these four.
By the way, speaking of stealing money, every university in America with bricks and mortars are stealing money as far as I'm concerned. You know. They're growing their tuitions at three
Amen.
Times the rate of
Joe
inflation.
Malone, you go, boy.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sorry, you have a final word, Michael.
Go ahead,
yeah,
Michael.
I just think it's sad that people invest in things that with dreams.
Okay, you want to hear something really sad? Did anybody see Miley Cyrus last night? Oh, my God. I'll end on that note.
I wish you would. Who is Joe Malone? What is this country coming to? And Michael Goldman, thanks so much.
Yeah,
great to see both of you gentlemen.
Right field, I guess.
Take care, guys.
Yeah, Michael Goldman's president of Goldman and Associates. Joe Malone, former Republican state treasurer. Thanks to both
and
of you for
Plymouth,
coming in.
What's the name
Plymouth
of
Rock Financial.
Plymouth Rock.
Yeah,
baby.
Buy rocks.
There we go.
With your insurance questions. So if you are tuned into this show, chances are that your ability to concentrate is being compromised. But stay tuned. We're going to talk about an environment where the airwaves are cluttered with noise. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. Marjorie Egan is off today. She'll be back tomorrow. Sitting in is Kara Miller. In yesterday's New York Times, there was this opinion piece by George Prochnik, I hope I pronounced his name right, entitled, "I'm Thinking, Please Be Quiet." Essentially, this guy breaks down all the ways that noise, from the hum of a refrigerator to a nearby phone conversation to the merciless assault of a jackhammer, keeps us from concentrating. Well, we're going to try to fine-tune this notion with a focus on the open office space. They're popular because they're supposed to foster creativity and collegiality. Just ask New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. But does the open workspace also make it harder for you to work? Our number is 877-301-8970. The pros and cons of the open office you all sit together. What's your take on this, Kara Miller?
You know, they're probably not going to let me back into the newsroom, but it's really hard for me. We have this open newsroom, which
is
great, and it does foster collegiality. I like the people around me and everything's really nice. But I have to say, when people are on the phone or having conversations, which is really great, I cannot focus on what I'm doing. I will have to walk around this building, find some empty office somewhere and sit in it and read stuff. No, it's totally true.
What's funny, Marjorie isn't quite as extreme as you, but we have a television over our head.
Oh, my gosh.
And it is always playing at a low volume. Marjorie says to me repeatedly, please turn that down. I can't concentrate. I am the exact opposite. If there is not motion and action and noise around me, not at a ridiculous level, but at a level that creates this environment, a certain kind of environment, I can't work.
I
shut a door in an office, I feel so isolate. I don't mean this as a matter of principle. I mean it operationally, just like you do. I can't think when there's silence. I can only think when there's action and noise around me.
Okay, so you're telling me you're sitting at your desk and the Steve Harvey show is on. Mm-hmm. And that
that's a bad example for you to choose.
And you're able then to focus on the president's saying about Syria.
You know what I was going to say to you, it was funny. I was about to say, we had a guest on a few weeks ago who said that multitasking doesn't work. I realized the guest was you, actually. You were just standing in a different part of the studio.
It's because multiple things were happening.
There's a different, and again, I don't have the scientific basis, and you may blow me away on this because I'm sure you do. I don't mean actual engagement in the noise that surrounds us. I mean, it creates, you know how some people play, like buy those ridiculous machines for $80 at Brookstone and it plays the ocean or birds in the background. It's the only way they can sleep. Some people need silence. Well, I need the birds. I need the ocean, but whatever the urban equivalent is, it may be a CNN playing in the background, a couple of my colleagues talking. I'd like that. And by the way, that's one of the reasons. I wasn't kidding before. Michael Bloomberg, when he was elected mayor, 2005, whatever year he was elected mayor, said, I'm not taking that elaborate office that mayors sit in. I am sitting, I think it's called the bullpen, when he was in the stock market, is in the center of the room where the action is for operational reasons and for environmental reasons. It's the way for him. And so that's what we want to get. I didn't realize we had two different opinions here, but we apparently do. What's yours? 877-301-8970. Is the open office thing work for you? Or do you need to segregate yourself, as Kara was saying a couple of minutes ago, to really think and get things done?
You know, I talked to Maynard Webb, who used to be the chief operating officer of eBay a few months ago, and he was saying it was great to have the open office. He used to sit next to Meg Whitman, who is the head of eBay. She
Former candidate for governor of California.
Exactly. She sat in a cube just like everybody else.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
is that
same
true?
As like Michael Bloomberg. Yeah. And he said it was great because she would turn to him after she got off the phone and she'd be like, we have to work on this thing. It's a real problem. He'd be like, yeah, I know. I overheard you were already working on it. So I think there's advantages, and there's certainly advantages to getting, you know, the boss out of the office and getting them in with everybody else. But I also think there's a lack of concentration. You cannot really deeply focus on things, and I have to say, research does show this, that you cannot really deeply focus on things when 10 other things are going on. And the piece that you talked about in the New York Times very interestingly said that even people who were great at sleeping through, let's say, airline noise, it says the findings were clear. Even when people stayed asleep, the noise of planes taking off and landing caused blood pressure spikes, increased pulse rates, and set off vasoconstriction and the release of stress hormones. So the idea is, like, you're sleeping, but even so, the human body is really primed to think about every little thing that's happening, because it makes sense. On the African savannah, you don't want to miss, you know, a lion coming up behind you.
877-301-8970. We're testing the open office concept with all of you. Are you for it? Are you getting it? What's your personal experience? Again, I couldn't live without it. I've had jobs where I've had my own office. And, you know, in days gone by, it's not so much this way anymore. In days gone by, that was a sign of some status. Essentially, the boss, the mid-level bosses, they get their own offices.
Absolutely.
But now it's a whole kind of mix. 877-301-8970. Let's start in Hingham, where Eddie is on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Kara Miller. Hey, Eddie.
How's it going?
Excellent. Thanks for the call. What's up?
Now, I was in sales for 45 years.
Yeah.
Now, the first 25, I was on the road, and when I called on a buyer or something like that, we were in a separate office, so there was no distraction,
mm-hmm.
and we could concentrate on what we were doing. Now, after that, for 10 years, I was selling cars, but I was in an open office. So you have customers at your desk, and there's four or five salesmen walking around talking, phones ringing. And the customers get distracted. So when you're negotiating the deal, their mind is going somewhere else, you know?
Is that good for you, Eddie, as somebody trying to make them negotiate the deal, that they've kind of forgotten the details of it?
No, I'm trying to explain stuff to
them. Oh, I thought you were saying what Kara thought, that you could put something over on
right,
somebody
exactly.
when they're distracted. That's not where you're going with this?
No.
Oh.
No.
Where are you going?
They get distracted.
Which is not a good thing for the salesperson. Is that where you are?
Because they're not hearing what I'm saying.
I got it. Eddie, thank you so much for the
call.
You know what I'm also thinking
Eddie's
about?
A smart man.
Well, you're not going to disagree with this, despite all your scientific background here, Karen Miller, is occasionally I'll be talking. We have a little pod, and our pod, just to tell, there are four desks at our pod. Yes, there are. There's me. To my left is Marjorie Egan. To her left is Chelsea Merz, our lead producer. And to her left and my right is Edgar B. Herwith.
Are we going to get into a pod throwdown
no,
here?
No, here's
whose
what
pod
we're
is
do.
Better.
Occasionally, I will say something to Marjorie. And somebody one pod over will hear, and they have far better ideas about what we should be doing than we have about what we should do. Essentially, it becomes this newsroom, this full newsroom debate about an issue. Or maybe, you know what I mean? It's like all these heads cooperating on something, despite what you say is undoable because they are all talking, they are doing phone things, they're whatever they're doing.
No. I definitely think there is this potential for collaboration. You know, I was talking to you about Maynard Webb and Meg Whitman and this ability to say, mm-hmm. you know what, I'm already working on your problem. I hear it. I know what you're saying. The other side of that is I sit next to the wonderful and talented Jared Bowen from television. And sometimes I will realize that I know more about the segment he's planning for tonight than the one I'm planning. And so I mean, the downside is you're listening to all sorts of things, even things you wish you weren't listening to, because they're there. And I mean, it's a narrative and it's going on right next to you. It's hard to kind of turn it off.
Can I tell you, the most creative minds are the best eavesdroppers. That's my position. And I'm sticking to it. Sheila, you're in Norton. You're on with Karen Miller and Jim Browdy on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Sheila.
Hi, guys. I agree with you, Jim. I can't be in an office by myself. I always think I'm missing something.
I'm
actually surprised. You're an only child.
I am.
I sort of attributed my needing like noise around at all times in the house and to being part of a litter. And yeah, it seems like my whole family's like that. I thought being with a group in the early stages of my life meant I wanted the noise later. So I'm actually surprised you like to be around the noise. However, I was going to say the New York Times is a cute word they make up every week in the magazine section.
Yeah.
And this week was faulty casting.
Yes.
I thought that was cute. So I think that's perhaps what happens when you have too much noise going on.
Well, that's Kara's position. Sheila, thank you for your call, as always. 877-301-8970.
Well, I just wanted to say one thing about the piece in the New York Times that we talked about called I'm Thinking, Please Be Quiet. It said what I think is so true. In American culture, we tend to regard sensitivity to noise as a sign of weakness or killjoy prudery.
Exactly.
I feel exiled.
I could have written
Jim.
That. Not quite as beautifully, but I could have.
But it is. This is the number one most emailed thing in the New York Times, because I think a lot of people feel, this is my feeling, they feel like me. They feel like they're sort of a killjoy for saying, can you turn that TV off? Can you be quiet?
So are you of the opinion that people don't have the ability to shut out what's around them except as an environmental? For example, I can't drive in the car without the radio on. I mean,
I
love the solitude
the radio,
of the radio,
yeah.
But whether it's listening to GBH or listening to music or whatever it is, well, then how can you focus on driving when you're doing that thing? Isn't that inhibiting your ability?
Somehow driving seems like a lighter task. If I'm trying to really focus on reading a book, it's hard for me to also listen to somebody on the phone next to me or like the Katie Couric show above me. Like you were saying, we've got TVs. And this is something I do that I'm sure people in the newsroom think I'm a total freak. Sometimes I will actually like hold my ears. I'm sure people look over and think,
wait a second, you stick your fingers in your ears while you're sitting at your desk?
The only other option is to leave my desk and go find an empty office. I'm telling you, Jim, this is a serious problem. I need some kind of a bubble, like a white noise bubble to be. Do you think you can make that happen?
I can speak to the boss after the show. 877-301-8970. We're talking open versus closed office and the pros and the cons and what your experiences have been. Let's go to Burlington, Vermont, where Cheryl's on with Jim and Kara. Hey there, Cheryl.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
I'm actually in the car. I'm not quite back in Burlington yet, but I have worked in an open office for about 2 years. We came from a space that had smaller offices, like 2 or 3 people in them. And I am very, I'm very outgoing. I engage with my colleagues quite a bit, even when we were in a separate office. And so I don't really need the open space to give me that level of collaboration. I don't have a problem going out to anyone and talking about anything about work. But
however,
one thing I have noticed is I do think I'm having a harder time concentrating, but the big thing for me is, when I leave work, when I get home, I don't want the radio on. I don't want anybody. I don't want to talk to anybody. I want peace and quiet. And I feel like there's a level of stress that I wasn't even aware of when I was at work. But as soon as I get out, I don't want anyone to talk to me. I need a space of time. It's almost like overstimulation. I don't necessarily realize it when it's happening, and I may actually be getting my job done, but when I'm done, I feel fried.
Cheryl, you need detox, is what you're saying.
I do. I feel like that. Like, I love to listen to public radio, and I listen to it in the car, or if I ride my bike home, I listen to it at home. But I don't want to. I don't want to hear anyone else talking.
Cheryl, what do you do? I don't mean you. What kind of business?
I'm an engineer, and I do energy efficiency consulting. So I do, you know, I interact with my colleagues, and I'm on the phone with people.
How many people work in this open office that you think is the cause of?
Total in the whole office is probably 200, something like that. It's broken into different kind of neighborhoods, they call them. But in my space, there's probably 50 or 60 people.
That's sort of comparable to our newsroom, I guess.
Yeah.
Cheryl, that was a great call. Thank you very
much. Thanks, Cheryl.
Detox was a great word too, Cara. That was that was quite good. Let's go to Rockland, where Kathy is on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call, Kathy.
Hi.
I
just wanted to relate that when I was a graduate student at the University of Connecticut, I found that I did some of my best studying at the cafeteria in the student union.
It's about time we got one of these callers. I'm so with you. Go ahead, Kathy. No, that's exactly how I am. Go ahead.
Well, I was forced to focus on things. And then later when I joined the regular working world, I was in a very open office. And I think that we have to lament the fact that good joke telling has dried up with people stuck in cubicles and segregated in offices because they just don't flow anymore. So,
Kathy, thank you for the. By the way, I forgot. In law school and undergraduate school, I did the exact same thing she did.
So there's a difference between white noise, like, you know, being outside and sort of hearing the cars go by or sitting on the beach or whatever, and having, you know, something very specific said right near you, people having a conversation. You end up eavesdropping even though you don't want to be. I mean, sometimes that's an easier conversation to listen to than the very complicated issue you're trying to deal with.
What do you do, by the way, when you mentioned proximity to Jared? When you overhear a conversation and you're dying to participate in it, do you preface your comment to him by saying, "I really hope you don't think I was eavesdropping," but, or you just break right into it?
Sometimes I just break right in.
Just go right
for
it. Yeah,
you know, I'm gonna have to talk to Jared when I get upstairs. But you know. That's right. So I definitely think, like you were saying with pods, I think people kind of almost expect in our newsroom that you're going to break in and you're going to sort of be part of that conversation.
Nobody's breaking in with you anymore, let me tell you. That's for sure. Let's go to Danvers, where Dennis is on with Kara Miller and me, Jim Browdy. Thank you for your call, Dennis.
Hi, I'm making a comment that's related to something you said, Jim, when you said you and Marjorie have a TV right over your heads and she hates it and you don't. I'm thinking of sitting at Boston Logan Airport with the monitors going like crazy with news and every other thing and sports and the airlines trying to make announcements and you just can't think. And this is not the kind of mood you want to be in before you're flying somewhere.
No, I think John's absolutely right. And, you know, a couple weeks ago, we talked about Clifford Nass, the professor from Stanford, who has done pioneering work looking at how well we do when we're distracted. And even people who think they are great at multitasking are not good at multitasking. So I think there's what we think of when we deal with this noise thing. And then there's the reality, which is that almost nobody can do A and B at the same time any good at it.
But I remember part of our discussion, and Dennis, thanks for the call with you a couple of weeks ago about this multitasking thing. But let me throw into this conversation what you broached a minute ago, white noise versus whatever the opposite is, active engagement noise.
Right.
So was that guy, when he was doing his research, talking about white noise as well, which is purely an environmental thing as opposed to a substantive distraction kind?
No, he was not talking about white noise. He was talking about people getting phone calls, people getting interrupted. I mean, the kind of stuff we've been talking about, like, you know, Marjorie hearing something above her head or you saying, hey, can you do this or whatever. And sometimes
she considers me white noise,
say. Well, then that should solve the problem for her. But when you're saying, when she's trying to read something and you say, hey, Marjorie, blah, 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 the time it takes for her to re-engage with whatever she's doing is actually really very substantial. So, I mean, I think that there's what people perceive, and then there's the actual productivity, which I personally think is in peril when you're distracted all the time.
We're going to get up to the newsroom after the show. There are going to be 50 individual offices with no air, closed doors. That's the other, let me throw another thing into this. And maybe this is aberrational to the newsroom at WGBH. I don't mean to go into all the intimate secrets. One, there's all this open air. I mean, beyond the fact that we have windows around 50%, which is beautiful, floor-to-ceiling windows, 50%. That's another huge plus, is you're out in a physically liberating environment. That's a good thing, right?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think maybe the intermediate here, and I think they do this actually. I've toured the New York offices of Google, which, by the way, amazing.
Are they?
Yeah, they've got.
Does anybody have a private office there or no?
I think people do, but I mean, they have the most amazing stuff. They have this library where the shelves with the books turn around, and there are secret compartment Googles. Anyway, I digress. But I think the key may be to have this open office, and not to have a rabbit warren, as you say, of all these little jail cells that we're all sitting in, but to have an open office, and then to have quiet rooms where people can go in, close the door, and like read a novel. If they have to interview
like a lot of
the
libraries
person,
do. I mean, a lot of libraries have a comparable thing.
Right, where they have to, you know, if they have to talk to somebody about something really deep and they need some time to immerse themselves in that, they don't bring their phone in, whatever, and it's the quiet room.
You're going to require the jaws of death to get me out of my seat in the newsroom. Let's take one more quick one if we can. Let's go to Melissa. You're in Saugus. You're on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Karen Miller. Hi there, Melissa.
Hi, Jim and Karen. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I just wanted to say that I think that one of the important things that we need to think about in this situation is the type of work that's being done and the culture of the organization. And so I just have a personal example where I used to work in a really sort of high-energy sales sort of environment, and there it was really important to sort of have that group sort of collaboration and feed off each other's energy. And I sat about 2 feet away from the person next to me. And in a new role, in a new organization, we do a lot of writing and analysis. And that's a very quiet sort of cubicle type, you know, office organization. So it's, you know, what is the department trying to accomplish or what is the company trying to accomplish? And what sort of environment nurtures that?
It actually sounds like it makes quite a bit of sense.
I was going to say,
Melissa
makes a great point. And I think it marries the two things we said, which is, can you imagine if instead your pod got broken up and you were in an office and Chelsea was in an office and Marjorie was in an office and Edgar was in an office. And every time you had to talk to them, you either had to pick up the phone or get up.
We'd have to cancel the show.
Yeah, exactly.
This next guy, I want to take him because he's an architect who obviously has a little bit of expertise in this area. Cam, you're in Boston, and apparently you are an architect. Welcome to Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Well, thank you very much. I think your last caller made an excellent point about the fact that there's always a break room or someplace that you can go, and good managers know how to do it. But what I wanted to say is I've been involved in this many times, and almost every time I've been involved in taking a group of closed offices and making it an open office space, everybody objects. But I've also found that when it's all done, everybody's very happy, and I could never figure out why this is. I've thought about it for a long time. I think part of it has to do with the democratization.
Absolutely.
Thing.
I'm so glad
there's
you said
question,
that.
Yeah. Yeah. Who gets an office and who doesn't? Because as your last caller said, these open office areas, if they're done well, there's more light, there's more air, and, you know, and probably fewer staff meetings.
Well, the best example of that I could think of is when I first read that Bloomberg, a billionaire who's a pretty powerful character, was elected mayor of New York City. And one of his first pronouncements was that he was not going to be in his elaborate mayoral suite or office, but rather plopping himself down in the middle of the newsroom, which is where was he at Goldman Sachs, wherever he was, which is how things were there. That's the democratization issue is a wonderful point. Kim, thank you for the call.
Yeah, it's a great call. And I think that is really important. It's kind of the message that it sends, the idea. And I think one of the very first people to do this was one of the pioneers of Silicon Valley, the CEO of Intel, who said, look, I'm going to have a cube just like everybody else. And that launched it in Silicon Valley, and it has launched it in other places, too. But the idea that we are all equal here and that there are no superiors and inferiors. So
exactly.
Great calls. Thanks very much. So we are going to come right back and talk about the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. It was one of the largest political rallies for human rights in U.S. history. And we're going to have a special edition of Open Mic. We're going to hear from one person who attended the march 50 years ago and another person who took part in the big commemoration in D.C. over the weekend. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
with this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day.
This past Saturday was a celebration of that March on Washington 50 years ago. On Wednesday, August 28th, Presidents Obama, Carter, and Clinton will celebrate the actual day. Joining us on Open Mic, it's a special day, is Reverend Eugene F. Rivers III. Hello, Reverend Rivers. How are
you?
He was there on Saturday, this past Saturday in Washington. Joining him today is Reverend Irene Monroe. She was there as a little girl 50 years ago today. Hello, Reverend Monroe.
Hello there, Jim.
How old were you?
I was 8 years old, a second grader.
Oh, my God.
It's amazing.
It was. It really was.
So what was it like? I mean, you were there on the scene. What was the Saturday like, Gene Rivers?
It was hot as it was 50 years ago. Lots of...
Were you there? You weren't there, were you?
No.
No, I didn't think so. Okay.
No. Very hot. Lots of speeches. One can imagine folks sat there 30 years ago listening to the lineup. What was more interesting was the backstory. So there are two narratives for me. There's the actual event and all the surface stuff. And you saw the coverage, all of it's utterly predictable. What was striking to me is what was not said. Mm. So everybody gets up. You got the usual suspects. It's the same stuff. You got Martin Luther King III, and you've got this one, that. So all the veterans. So one, you saluted all of the memory of the martyrs and those folk who gave their lives and put their bodies on the line in ways for which, and we'll come back to this in the second session, there's no analog. Mm-hmm. Folk put their bodies on the line and bled and died. All right, so it's a unique thing. So it was very moving to me, all the surface, you know. The more interesting piece was the politics of the march. Anybody that's read Taylor Branch and did a careful reading, the backstory was more interesting than the front story.
What was the backstory that was so interesting?
It was, at one level, an attempt at a coronation for Reverend Alfred Sharpton. It was a political coronation, right? So that's one subtext of this business, if we have the adult conversation. The other part of it was that there was no agenda. Unlike 50 years ago, there was a legislative agenda, Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act. There was a jobs agenda around the Marshall Plan that A. Philip Randolph had been calling for since the 1940s. No agenda.
And the freedom part of the actual original march was like an add-on. The real march was for jobs.
Yeah. That's right.
Right. So there are two pieces. The freedom part was the legislative piece, Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act. Then the jobs piece, none of that. So
can I say what you texted me, what your description was in a text you sent me Saturday? Am I allowed to
sure.
do that?
You're
the Civil Rights AARP meeting is what Gene Rivers
said. Yeah, it was an AARP reunion. It was a Civil Rights AARP reunion.
Were there, the original thing, Irene Monroe, 50 years ago. From afar, you weren't there on Saturday, were you?
No, but I was glued to the television.
And give us your analysis of now and then.
And I have to agree with Eugene on many of his points, because I just thought it was high on celebration and very little on substance. I must say—
Booyah.
Okay, I must say, I got more of an impetus to go out and change the world or believe I had the capacity to do so as an 8-year-old in 1963 than I do here, you know, in 2013. I thought that it didn't address stuff like, you know, focus on the privatization of education, reproductive justice. It needed to talk about the new Jim Crow, the prison industrial complex. It needed to talk about the working poor. And so it didn't do that.
Why? But what both of you are saying is so obvious. It isn't like it's an agenda where I can see people, the organizers, sitting in a room of another big rally and say, well, we can't do X or Y because we don't all agree on X or Y. Who doesn't agree on all the things that you and Gene Rivers were talking about? So why wasn't that center
stage? Can I say this? This is what I thought. I thought it was a much more grandiosity in terms of its presentation. I thought it was a bigger version of the Tavis Smiley State of the Union address to Black America. Other than instead of being on C-SPAN, it was on MSNBC and it was at the mall. But other than that,
so you're both pretty disappointed.
No, I'm not disappointed. No,
well,
au contraire.
Well, then explain.
No. I had no expectations. Oh, I knew
what
this was
going to
be. No, I had no expectations. I knew exactly what this was going to be.
Well, because you're cynical. I don't mean that as a criticism.
No, not cynical at all. No. If you do the homework, there were no surprises. No. I want to be real clear about this. I had no expectations because I'm from Philly. I have no innocence to lose. My brother, no innocence to lose. So I knew exactly what this was supposed to be. Reverend Sharpton, to his credit, with a radio station and his MSNBC gig, had got this thing structured so that he was coronated as the official ideological underboss of the Obama administration. So, no. There was no disappointment. I didn't have anything to do with it.
I know, but you know what?
Let's be adults about this thing.
I do hear you when you say that, you know, given the cast of characters. And I need to say, I went to school with Al Sharpton. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I kind
of
knew that.
What level of school did you go to school?
This was Tilden High School in Brooklyn, New
York. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah,
I didn't know
same graduating class of 1973.
God bless you.
And lived in the same housing projects.
Young people. Young people.
Yeah, right. But the thing is this, is that, that while we understand what Al is doing, I mean, we have to, you know, I have great respect for Eric, you know, Holder.
He was fantastic.
And great respect for Booker, you know, Cory Booker. Yeah,
I mean,
those people. I think the thing that bothered me most was that we didn't see, one of the things about the movement was it was going to correct history, the narrative of it. So there was some talk about Bayard Rustin as one of the architects there. But then again, you know, when I was watching BET, you had Eleanor Holmes Norton who talked about, we're not talking about the women. You know, Mega Evers' widow said, where are the women? So we didn't give homage to Dorothy Height, who was one of the organizers,
right,
or Ella Baker,
right,
you know, or
absolutely,
Fannie Lou Hamer.
Absolutely.
So here again, we had a movement that, I guess you said it, you know, appropriately. It was the March AARP. Nothing really changed.
Did you both, one of the really interesting historical
and
things.
And we never agree on anything. I just want
you
to say.
Rivers.
Yeah, no. Rivers and I never agree.
On a rare occasion,
did
right?
Did you both read?
You know, I ascend to her level of insight and illumination.
Did you, either of you read, Karen and I were talking this much, read a piece in the Washington Post that this, I think it was Saturday, maybe Sunday morning, where a columnist, and my apologies for forgetting the name,
I think I know where you're
wrote
going.
About the coverage of the March on Washington 50 years ago in the Washington Post. This is a great little factoid.
Yeah.
60 people were, quote, deployed to cover, some reporters, some production people, that's 60 people. There were 24 stories written about the original march in the Washington Post. 23 of them neither mentioned Martin Luther King or the I Have a Dream speech. One of them mentioned I Have a Dream in the fifth paragraph, almost as an afterthought. Again, I'm asking you to hearken back to being 8 years old.
Right.
When you're standing there, was King not?
No,
so he wasn't the runaway.
I wasn't. You know, it's very interesting in black community back then. You know what you do for the summer if you can't afford to go to camp, you go to Bible camp. Your church does.
Amen.
And so that whole entire summer, we were spending that summer, you know, doing signage about jobs, mm-hmm, and freedom. It was a tumultuous, you know, second year for me as a grade schooler because of busing. I had been bused out of my black neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York, and was in, you know, and bust into a white neighborhood. So my whole thing was, what can I possibly do as an eighth grader? And there was much discussion among church folks, should we take the kids, should we not? And they decided to take us because they said that how we would be civil rights leaders was that we needed to go back to our third and to our grades, whatever grades we had been promoted to, and be the best student that we could be. That if we had graduated with a high school diploma, and goodness, if we made it to college, that would be a symbol that time wasn't wasted.
But you didn't leave the event as an 8-year-old or in your family and friends saying, talking about King and nothing but King.
King was one of many
really
outstanding ministers. Clearly at that
but
point.
But one of
when
many.
One of many. See, what happened is Mahalia Jackson sang. She was singing her song and we had to shut up. But those are the kids, like, you know, we're talking.
Right.
Then King came and folks were saying to me and others, hush child. It was, yes, it was King, but it was more about a black minister was at the pulpit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we knew that
right.
We were going to go to church.
That's right. No,
and
I mean,
isn't that the nature of history, though, you know, where you experience something and there's all these complexities and then it gets boiled down or it evolves. I mean, you even think about something like Harry Truman leaving office.
Sometimes
right?
It evolves.
Not
that's
popular.
Right. Right.
And
right.
Then
right.
In retrospect, we say, wow, Harry Truman,
and
what
September,
a great president.
The September cover of the Look magazine, if you remember.
From that year.
From 1963.
Right.
You had Bayard Rustin
and Philip Randolph.
Right. You didn't have King.
In fact, let me pick
and
up
so
on
the,
your...
Yeah.
By the
go
way,
ahead,
that's
please.
The voice of Reverend Irene Monroe. The other voice is our regular on Monday.
No, no.
At
and
1
talk
o'clock,
about why they
Reverend
switched
Rivers.
That narrative.
Right, right. No,
why
no,
the
no.
focus...
Okay. One of the fascinating things that Irene has just pointed out revolves around the King business and how little white America across the board understands how black, and it's a completely different universe, because what happens, King has a prepared text. He's going along with the text. Then Mahalia says, okay. Martin, tell about the dream.
That's right.
Martin, tell about the dream. She hollers at, right?
Right.
King then moves off the text. And the thing that the entire world remembers is when he takes off.
That's right.
On his thing about the red clay of Georgia and my character and all that. When he goes through that, he is now off script.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And
he was
taken
told.
Off.
He was told, right? Like, keep it under 10 minutes. Right. And
that's
he
right.
did.
No.
And then, when she said,
tell it, Martin, tell
yeah,
it.
Right. Yeah.
That's right.
And what's significant about the business, and go back to your thing about the king. See, King was only one of a couple of hundred what we call
That's
super
right.
hoopers. I mean, black preachers who blow the house out.
That's right.
So white America said, oh, my God, I've never heard preaching like that. Well, you know, sorry for you. Because this young man is simply one of a bunch of black preachers, Baptist black preachers, who could have got up there and wrecked the house.
Let's bring it 50 years forward to this past Saturday. Here's the Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, addressing Saturday's crowd.
We must remember generations who carried themselves on a day-to-day basis with great dignity in the face of unspeakable injustice, sacrificing their own ambitions so that the opportunities of future generations would be assured. But for them, I would not be Attorney General of the United States, and Barack Obama would not be President of the United States of America.
Now, Reverend Irene Monroe, despite that comment, and I assume there are a lot of people who agree, the Pew Center on Social and Demographic Trends did a pretty comprehensive poll this week. The question was, how much progress towards Martin Luther King's dream of racial equality do you think the U.S. has made over the last 50 years? 48% of whites thought a lot of progress, only 32% of blacks. And then they go on to compare some statistics. Black unemployment 50 years ago was 10%. It's now 12.8%.
That's right.
Wage gap, roughly the same. Poverty levels, roughly the same. Incarceration of blacks versus white actually increased. So do your own, be your own responder to the Pew Research poll. How have we done in 50
years?
What
happened is that we look at this rather topically. So when we look at people like Jay-Z and Oprah, and we look at our professional, you know, athletes, we say, look, they've overcome. I mean, we look at even Tiger Woods, okay, because we're entering into these precincts that we couldn't once upon a time do that. So when you have a topical dressing and underneath is still the paradigm hasn't changed, what happens is you still have that permanent underclass. And so what happens is that, and we don't control, that permanent underclass doesn't have a voice. So you take someone like a Eugene who will give it a voice, tell the truth, but then again, he's not on MSNBC. See, he's not going to get a show.
He's on Boston Public Radio. But Irene, if you were asked the question, how much progress towards Martin Luther King's dream of racial equality in the last 50 years, there were three choices: a lot, some, little, or none. What would your answer have
been? I'd say some.
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 What would
absolutely.
You have said, Gene
I'd
Rivers?
Say that for the very black and poor, it's worse. The numbers are worse. When you look at out of wedlock births, when you look at not simply out of wedlock, you know, single parent households, when you look at the mass incarceration, conditions in the inner cities are actually more violent and terrible. I mean, you got madness, terror, and nihilism in inner cities that's worse now in 2013 than it was in 1963,
yeah.
If you're black and poor.
Reverend Eugene Rivers, you know, people often talk about money being the bottom line. I looked at the net wealth of the average black family versus the average white family.
Right.
Average white family, just to 2009, last numbers that are available, $113,100. $113,100 for the average white family. Average black family, $5,700. I mean,
oh my
that
God.
Is
yeah.
a gap.
Yeah.
That is a yawning gap. And if money is the bottom line, if the issue of poverty, kids in poverty, is the bottom line, we've got a serious problem. I don't think people realize that.
But the deeper thing, to go back to what Irene said originally, none of that was addressed. The difference between 63 is that the intellectual architects, Rustin and Randolph, had an agenda. There was their version of a Marshall Plan. It had a legislative component, economic development component in terms of employment. There is no intellectual infrastructure. The difficulty of what happened Saturday is that it is not part of any theoretical policy or programmatic agenda. There was none of the above.
Yeah, but it isn't part of the problem. I'm not defending it. I'm trying to explain it. If both of you, and you both have the same conclusion, you and Irene Monroe, isn't part of the problem is there's a black president. And if it turns out that black leaders are on the mall on Saturday saying that all these things after 5 years are worse, as you would say, or some progress, as you would say, it's in essence criticizing the man at the top, is it not?
Well, what happens is it puts a gag order on us. See,
exactly, that's what I'm saying.
Is that if you're white and you critique it, you're racist. And if you're black, you're considered a sellout. So in many ways, what happens is that go along to get along. It's this is the kind of attitude. So we've lost the kind of black leadership. And because of so many folks who, I hate using this term, but have sold out similarly as they also sold out differently, but sold out nonetheless in the Bush administration. So when you got compromising what Gene would say, Negroes, you know, and I would say accommodationist or assimilationist black folks, what happens is, you know, we don't have any movement. We have a topical change here.
I think it's interesting. I think it's interesting. You know, Jim said we've got a black president, and people always say that. It bothers me a little bit because we have a president who is as much white as he is black.
No, he's not.
No, but it says a lot about our culture.
Barack Obama didn't play that card.
Listen to me now.
You have to understand. See, there is blackness as a biological thing where we quibble.
Right. That's right.
Then there's blackness as political fact. Obama says, no, I'm not biracial. I'm black.
Politically.
When I can't get it. No. Listen to me now. Understand how black people see it. I understand your view. Black people see it. He sees it. He self-identifies as a black man, not biracial, not from Indonesia, not from Hawaii, not from Kansas. I'm a black man, and I know it because I can't get a cab to Harlem.
No. End of story. That's exactly what I was going to say, because he's perceived by others as black.
No. He made a decision. No, you ain't read the biography. He made a decision. I'm black. He went from Barry to Barack. That was from Negro, biracial, for the white people, to black.
When he can't get a cab to Harlem,
because he's black, he has not
talked to the cab driver about the decision he's made. The cab driver perceives himself that way.
But Eugene is not saying that Barack Obama is going around incognito. Okay.
Tell assistant.
What he's saying is that he's using that as political and economic currency.
He ain't okay. Biracial,
now
black.
We understand that he was raised by
a white mother, and we understand this.
He doesn't have a lot of the cultural markers and sensibilities that is someone who grew up, you know, with
black. I want to say something to both of the reverends here. There is far too much agreement between two people who agree on almost nothing. So we're going to take a break.
Listen.
And after the break, what's coming up, Karen
it's
Miller?
Black.
We are
the brother's
gonna,
black.
We're going to keep talking with Reverend Eugene
Effers.
Well,
I say incognito.
Oh,
okay.
Boy.
Go ahead.
They probably will keep talking during the break, too.
Thank you,
Reverend Eugene Rivers, the third co-founder of the Boston 10-Point Coalition, and Reverend Irene Munro, a columnist for Bay Windows and the Huffington Post. We're going to bring you on the other side a debate about gay marriage and civil rights. So sit down. Get ready for this. We've been promising to have it. This is 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Today it is a tale of two reverends, Reverend Eugene F. Rivers III, who is with us every Monday. He's joined today by Reverend Irene Munro. This part of the discussion actually came out of a discussion we had with Reverend Rivers on Boston Public Radio exactly 3 weeks ago today. Listen.
The reality is that it is almost impossible to assume a dissenting view on the issue of gay marriage. Now, because it's...
Dissenting mean an opposing view.
Opposing. You know, there's no audience anywhere where you don't get run out of town because you don't take the party line on this. It is ideologically impossible to have a rational conversation that says there might be another view to this issue.
Reverend Eugene Rivers, okay, let's bring this up again.
Let's get it on.
Okay. So you're saying, now, would you say this is true also when you're talking with black leaders? Or
Actually, do you want to go there? You ready?
Okay, I'm ready.
Let's get it on now. Listen, not only is it true with black leaders, I'm going to give you a fact that Irene and I just talked about in the green room. Have you ever heard of an individual by the name of Donnie McClurkin?
No.
He is simply one of the most famous gospel singers on the planet Earth. He is internationally recognized, all kinds of Grammy Awards, et cetera, et cetera. Donnie McClurkin committed the political crime of writing a memoir about his life where he said, I was sexually abused as a kid, got turned out, which is an expression in the black church. Irene knows what I'm talking about, right? I got involved in the gay lifestyle. Then I had a conversion experience. And his words, not mine, his words, right? So, you know, freedom of speech, even for the folk that don't agree with us, right? He said, I had a conversion experience, and I no longer affirm that to be gay is consistent with my understanding of Christian teaching. Not everybody's, his. He was invited to sing, not to speak. One of the biggest scandals is going to blow up in the next 2 weeks or so. And he was disinvited. The mayor of the city says, we're for inclusion, except if you have the wrong political line. The most one of the most famous gospel singers in the world who was not politically there to do anything. He was disinvited and said he ran out of town.
Okay, Reverend
Black.
Monroe.
Well, you know, Eugene, you know, on one level, he's talking about a kind of liberalism, a rigidity around a liberal thought. But the bigger issue here is that, you know, Mayor Menino did something similar. Every summer we have the Gospel Fest.
Right.
And Donnie McClurkin one year was the key singer. And he was disinvited. And
it happened, and
there was a lot of talk about it, and largely because of two things. One is that it's wonderful to say, look, I was once upon a time gay.
Right.
And I've had this conversion experience. It's two things. One, to talk about ex-gay ministry and talk about it as that it's a lifestyle as opposed to a way of being.
Right.
And number two is that his continued homosexual behavior. He has this well-known song, you know, we all fall down, but we get up and he gets up and goes home to his male lover.
Right.
So there's the hypocrisy about that as well.
Now, is that true?
And the hurtful thing that he does around this ex-gay ministry rhetoric of his, very much living a DL in, you know, a down low in the closet lifestyle.
Can we get back to a more mainstream discussion for a second? There's okay. I'm serious. No.
Okay.
I don't mean
fair
that.
Enough.
55-40, most recent poll, largest numbers in American history in favor of gay marriage. You're part of the 40%, Gene Rivers.
Sure.
You're part of the 55%. There is some legitimacy to what Reverend Rivers said to us 3 weeks ago to me and Marjorie, is there not? That on most issues, if you're on the minority side, and I mean the minority in terms of numbers side, then you have a debate and people disagree. Here, it is a real problem, and it's not just in Massachusetts. If you come down on the 40% side, you are sort of run out of town, aren't you? Isn't that a fair statement?
Well, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. But I think what we need to look beyond just the idea of being run out of town, the harm that it does. I mean, it'd be similarly if let me give you an example. I mean, people as African Americans, we understand this here in a way in terms of, you know, if 50% of the people say, you know, blacks have a right, and then another 40-some percent say blacks don't, I mean, we would take a similar kind of aggressive, you know, opposition to that because it's outright discrimination.
But,
and I think what happens is that it's not that we disagree. It's the way in which you disagree that is hurtful, demeaning, and dismissive of a people.
No, you know what? I agree. Okay. Irene, I completely agree. And unfortunately, see, I'm going to disappoint you white people today, right? Because y'all expecting a whole bunch of hoo-ha that ain't probably going to happen. In fact, I want to go further than that. Number one, a lot of the language around the issue for the minority position is coarse, vulgar, and stupid. It is coarse, vulgar, and stupid. It's coarse, vulgar, stupid. In fact, now some of this is white people because some of the stuff is so crazy. I've never heard it before. I've seen these signs, God hates fags, stuff, language like that. I've never heard that in my... That's crazy. That's some white people stuff I don't know nothing about.
Well, in all fairness,
the
last time I saw a sign like that, I'm not saying they don't exist,
right,
are people like the nuts from the Westboro Baptist Church. I mean,
yeah,
that's their stock and trade.
No,
but they're outliers. That's like describing... You know,
but when he talks...
Rhetoric has a theological qualifier. This is the way black folks say it, okay? Okay, we love the sinner, but hate the sin, yet enjoy the music we bring.
I agree with that with a qualifier. I completely agree with that, right? See, the black church's homophobic line, which is, right? Well, one of the gayest institutions in black America is the black church. And gays have a black church. It's called a choir. Hello, right? And my point is that we have not had a nuanced conversation precisely for the reasons that Irene said. Let me, I have written that the black church's view on the entire homosexual debate is backward, but not for the reasons that the other side says. The black church doesn't have a homophobic problem. The black church got a sex problem. The black church is bad on all of it.
Yeah, but Gene, isn't it fair to say, I want to play another bite from you from August 5th. Isn't it fair to say that your position, and maybe this is why one does get run out of town, is an anti-civil rights position? You and I started having a discussion. Well, I'll play it for you. Here's Gene Rivers. You'll first hear me. This is on August 5th as well. Listen to this. You'll hear Rivers. Then we'll continue the discussion. Here it is. Civil rights are civil rights. And if it turns, that's like saying, to me at least, that's like saying 40 years ago there was no place at the table for somebody to believe that blacks weren't entitled to the same rights as whites. Why is that different?
Jim, do you really want to have that conversation?
I think I actually do.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. Now, I don't know if we have the time to have an adult conversation on this.
Do you want to hold it till next week? Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm good. I would love to do it. Right, you understand? And I'm comfortable being wrong.
Okay, so we've held it for 3 weeks, and here we are. Right. And what led to that little back and forth with you and me was the whole notion, I think it flowed from the gay marriage discussion, is that we're discussing basic civil rights. Like, for decades, we discussed the civil rights of blacks, and to many of us, the fight for civil rights, for equal rights for gays, is the exact same fight 50 years later. You don't agree with that.
Now, see, there are some presuppositional differences that we have which inform this discussion. So, for example, if I operate from the presupposition that this is a preference, right, then I say, well, not all preferences are rights.
But you're denying science when you say it's
well,
a preference.
No. Let's talk about that. Now, let's talk about science. You see, 70 years ago, there was a woman named Margaret Sanger who was the patron saint of all white feminists who promoted science. In this case, it was eugenics. And she argued, this white feminist argued that there should be population control and that we need to limit the colored races. Now, white feminists were completely silent on this, as this woman promoted one of the most racist conceptions of science, which was then refuted, that science, by Stephen Jay Gould and a number of other people. Yeah, it's real. Now,
okay,
so if we're gonna go there, we really have to go there, because this
well,
conversation
Monroe
gets
can
a
go
lot
there
deeper.
Right now.
Okay,
I think
there are a couple of things here. You know, when we talk about civil rights here, we set up this what I call a hierarchy of oppression. And what has happened, the way in which we've talked about civil rights in this country, it has been within a black context. So what happens is that you'll get into the 70s and you have black. You have the feminist movement going on, and you have the LGBT movement, and then they'll ask black women or whatever who have multiple identities, you know, are you more oppressed being black or being gay? Also, what operates here too is that the larger African American community see gayness as a white issue, a white disease. But what also happens here too is that what we don't understand as a community, meaning African American, that the differences in historical oppression doesn't negate the fact that this oppressed group isn't afforded a civil rights. And so that's what happened. Because we have not made the kind of coalition building with other groups that are oppressed, we think that we got a patent on oppression by being black, ignoring the folks that are oppressed within our group who are women as well as LGBTQ.
I'm going to get in here. No, I want to get in here. I want to get right to the core of this question. To just put aside the politics for a minute, white church, black church, all that stuff. I brought in my Bible, as I do, you know, most days, and I opened
you read,
it.
Oh, you read? Oh, okay.
No, I don't.
Okay.
Most days.
I didn't think so.
But I do have it
at
home.
I didn't think
day.
He was telling the truth.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Go ahead.
So I open it up to Leviticus and find, as you know,
irrelevant
text. Rivers would say, 18:22, do not lie with a man as one lies with a woman, that is detestable.
Okay.
I read further in Leviticus. Leviticus 19:19. Do not mate different kinds of animals. Do not wear clothes worn of different kinds of material. Do not cut the hair at the sides of your head or clip off the edges of your beard. Keep all my decrees and follow them. I am the Lord your God. So I just wonder.
And?
You know,
and?
Well, you don't have a beard.
No. But see.
So what I'm wondering is why some things are accepted and why other things are jettisoned.
Can I say something about that? What happens is, Reverend Rivers,
part of
the difficulty with the proof texting deal is that that's not my argument. So what you just read is irrelevant. My argument, and I've said this repeatedly, nationally. In fact, the essay that I wrote in the Weekly Standard. So let's leave the fundamentalist Bible thing. See, the right-wing people are supposed to do that, not you, right? WGBH can do better than quoting some antiquated...
Well, you say what you want to say.
But my point is this. The point I'm making in response to reading scriptures that aren't relevant to my argument is that when we talk about the hierarchy of oppression business, part of the difficulty, Irene, and we're not going to get over this, is that the level of alienation of the black community, period. Not straight black community, is that there is the perception that the David Geffens and the Rosie O'Donnells of the world, who bankrolled a lot of the politics, right? When they paint themselves as Emmett Till and Rosa Parks, I'm trying to tell you, you have lost black people, including most of the black gay people. No, you do not understand. I want to be real clear about this. The level of racial division outside of Harvard Square, WGBH, and San Francisco on this issue. So the Bible thing has nothing to do with it.
Is that a religious argument that you're making?
No, you misunderstand. Let me use this in English. My argument is philosophic and anthropological. It has nothing to do with the Bible.
Reverend Monroe,
Eugene is absolutely correct to talk about the racial divide within the LGBT community. It does not ignore the homophobia within our own community. And number one is that while Eugene can discard the Bible, as you using it as a way to uphold your premise, it doesn't ignore the fact that that has tremendous undergirding in his own particular homophobia, whether he espouses it or not. And so what happens is that we use a hermeneutic of suspicion. We will ignore everything in the Bible that says anything damning about black people. But, you know, Paul says, be obedient to your slave masters. No black person today is going to uphold that. But the point is that we will uphold, meaning black community, sexist statements in the Bible, classic example, looking at the March on Washington again, where were the women? So the point is that you need the Bible to make your argument. But Eugene, what you're trying to say is that, yes, there is racism in the LGBT community, but none of us who are LGBTQ is going to ignore the homophobia that we face in our community anymore.
Gentlemen, lady, if I just may, while this conversation is quite something.
I actually agree.
We only have about a minute left. Why don't you give us your final thought on this, Gene Rivers, and then Irene Monroe will give hers.
Just for the benefit of those, there is a movement that does not use the Bible. That's not our shtick, right? So if you want to beat us with that, you shot a blank. For us, there are some fundamental philosophic differences which have to do with a dissenting view of the anthropology of human sexuality that we did not get into because we talked about stuff that was irrelevant, right? Proof texting, some fundamentalist text. On the issue of homophobia, I want to go back to Irene's point. I completely agree that there is a sex problem, of which homophobia is simply a subtext. There is a sexual problem which has to do with the moral and political failure of the black church, right? That has to do with sexism, that has to do with stuff that's much worse than that. So, I agree completely with Irene. Now, and all I'm asking for,
wrap it up.
All I want is a rational discussion, not proof texting with isolated texts that you eisegete as opposed to exegete. Let's have a rational conversation and an adult conversation on the Bible.
Reverend Monroe, you can wrap up today, but I should say on behalf of the show, this will continue in future weeks. Go ahead, Reverend Monroe.
It's easy to say that the black church has a sex problem. Yes, I mean, when it comes to human sexuality and we look at the AIDS epidemic, certainly. But if we look at the AIDS epidemic, what undergirds that kind of inaction that we have is homophobia. The bigger problem is about black... Let me just say this. The bigger problem is about black masculinity and how that is constructed. And anything that is perceived to be effeminate okay, becomes a problem. And that's why we get back to homophobia, that once we can rid or purge ourselves of that sin, then women will have equal rights in the church. You'll see more of us, you know, in terms of leadership position.
I agree
and
with
it wouldn't have been that paucity again.
I
50
agree.
Years later
amen.
Of no women at the
there
March
we go. We've got amen.
I want an amen to that too. Reverend Eugene Rivers, Reverend Irene Monroe. Thank you both.
Poppin',
we
baby.
Will continue in weeks. They're shaking hands now.
I love
yeah,
the
and
job.
When we come
thank
back,
you both.
Film critic Garen Daly talks about the plight of the drive-in movie theater. We really shift gears. I'm Kara Miller. He's Jim Browdy. We'll be back. This is 89.7 WGBH.
Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. Kara Miller is sitting in for Marge Regan. A little bit of a change of pace here. We're going to pay tribute to an American pastime.
Welcome to your favorite drive-in theater and a sparkling new season. Watch our screen and local newspapers for all the fine shows coming this way. Show after show will feature the latest hits, the biggest stars for fun-filled, pleasure-packed evenings. Relax, come as you are, and spend an enjoyable night out with the entire family.
I'm on my way. We're talking about drive-ins, why they may be doomed, what folks are doing to save them. Here with us in Studio 3 to explain is film critic Garen Daly. He's also the director and producer, as you know, of the forthcoming documentary, The Orson Welles Complex. Hello again, Garen.
Hi, guys.
Hi. So it's interesting. I have never been to a drive-in movie.
You really?
Yeah, and I know there are still a few around, but I have to say, when I was growing up, there didn't see. There's some on the Cape, but we didn't go to the Cape.
Right.
So to me, it is what was in that clip, that sort of 1950s American Graffiti. I mean, that sort of romance of something that's gone. But I guess they're not totally gone, although they are in danger.
Right. And I think that that's one of the reasons why they're still around is people love that nostalgia. And it's interesting, the arc of the business of what a drive-in was. When it first started out, or when it really started coming into its own in the 50s, as you were talking about, it was all about families having a cheap, entertaining night. They had playgrounds and petting zoos and all this kind of stuff, bringing families in there. Then in the 70s and 80s, as tastes changed and drive-ins went out of favor, they became places for exploitation movies. Everything from cheesy double features of sci-fi films to porno. And then they are now coming back to a family-oriented center where it is cheaper to go to a drive-in with a family of four or five because it's only like 20, 30 bucks for a carload than go to a regular movie theater.
And in that 50s, when you described that, I didn't know this till this morning, roughly a third of all screens in this country were drive-in screens. And now, according to a piece we all read today, there are roughly 350 of these left in the country. As we're talking to Garen, by the way, we'd love to hear your memories. What did drive-ins mean in your life, either today or when you were growing up? It's 877-301 89.7. And we're told that you had a personal experience.
This is going to get racy.
No, it's not going to get racy. It's actually kind of embarrassing. But, I came from a very small town, and I came back after being away. I think it was first year of college. And I dated a girl 2 years younger than me. Named Bunny Andruzzi, who was the pharmacist's
daughter.
What
was her name again? Bunny Andruzzi.
Bunny Andruzzi.
Okay. Bunny, okay.
I mean, who named
her
kids? What
was her real name?
Bunny.
Bunny.
No, that was her
what?
Real name.
Bunny.
That's what makes this story so
That's
good.
That's a mistake.
Yeah. So anyways, I hadn't been around for a while, and I said, let's go to a drive-in. And so we go to the drive-in, and it had gone porno since I had been away. So I'm bringing this 17-year-old girl, 16-year-old girl, to a porno drive-in. I'm embarrassed. She's into it.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the great lines in a story read this morning by this guy, Anthony Paletta, it says, drive-ins, for all their family friendliness, were regarded, likely with fair reason, as hothouses of immorality. I mean, that did change. It went from the family, well, I don't know where it went from, but part of the allure for a lot of young people, teens, was a place you could make out with your girlfriend or vice versa, right?
Rather than the back row of the theater, you would do it in the front row of your seat or your car.
And the the threat that they're facing, and I was not aware of this. I mean, I understood that with suburbanization, obviously the value of the real estate is so dramatic that a lot of places can't afford it. But there's also the digitalization.
Right.
Well, explain that to people.
Well, I mean, what it has decided is the industry has decided they're going to save $1 billion a year by converting over to digital. That's the real motivation why all these movie theaters are moving over to digital. When it comes to drive-ins, they have to convert by the end of this year because there'll be no more 35-millimeter prints. It's the end of the road for 35-millimeter prints. So they can't show it. So they have to upgrade to digital. Now, most of the drive-ins are not part of chains. They're small independents. Mm-hmm. The conversion cost just for the projector is roughly $70,000.
And then you have to keep it, like, climate stabilized.
Exactly. And that's another $20,000 or $30,000. So roughly you're talking about $100,000 to convert over when these guys only have, what, maybe 5 months of season.
So what does that mean? So if we have 357, according to this writer, as of the time he wrote, I think it was earlier this summer, post this deadline for digitalization, how many theaters are we going to have?
That is why there's a movement out. Honda, by the way, is doing this big program now called Save the American Drive-In, and there's a website that will be on your website to let people know where they can go. The industry has responded in some ways. There's a company called Cinedigm, which is working with the industry group that is helping the transition, and they're going to fund about 100 conversions. But that still leaves about 250 that are still up in the air. Some of them, like the Skowhegan in Maine, is trying to do a fundraiser, but they've been doing a fundraiser now for 2 weeks, and they've got $385.
You know what I don't understand about this, and we're talking to Garen Daly about the threats to drive-ins, and we'd love to talk to you about the role that drive-ins played in your life at 877-301-8970. We'll get to your calls in a second. The Wellfleet drive-in, which maybe I went to a drive-in when I was a teenager outside Philadelphia. I think I did. But I know I've been to a drive-in when my kids were young in Wellfleet for all those reasons. What Wellfleet has done, which I assume they all should do or will do, or I'm surprised they haven't done, is they're sort of multitasking entities. There's a miniature golf course there on weekends during the day, maybe even all day, for 7 days a week during the summer season. There's a flea market. So essentially, you get to use the real estate in a number of ways. Isn't that sort of diversification one of the ways these places can survive?
It is one of the ways, but again, it depends on your population density. The nice thing about Wellfleet is it's at the tip of the Cape, and so there's tons and tons of people there in the summer, which is their season. You know, in the winter, it's a whole different story.
Do any drive-ins operate in the winter?
No, very few. I mean, unless you're in a warm climate.
And it's not just a question of real estate in the suburbs got more expensive, which priced the drive-in movie theaters out, which is true. But I also feel like people now have huge TVs in their living room. You know, you talked about, it's cheaper than going to a movie to have $20-$30 for a carload of people. Well, yeah, but I'll give you something else that's even cheaper. Getting a Netflix movie, you know, and sitting on your couch with the entire family. And a lot of people now have these huge screen TVs and pretty nice home theater systems. Hasn't that partially competed with the drive-in movie too? Like, if you're taking the family out?
Yeah, but that's also competing with all the theaters right now. That's why everyone has to. So you have to come up with different ways. You have to become better showmen.
Well, so IMAX and 3D, you can't, you know, that's harder to do at home, although.
Right. But again, the entire industry is facing a very crucial period of time. The drive-ins happen to be right now one of the striking points because they are literally threatened with extinction.
Have you been to a drive-in as an adult? We know about you and Bunny. We've heard about that now.
Yes, I have.
You have? And where did you go?
I went to the Milford Drive-In in New Hampshire.
And how was that?
It was all right. I mean, one of the problems you have with the drive-ins is you don't have really high-quality sound. And that's always an issue.
They still hook the little things to the windows
in
the car?
No, now you can do it through your FM in your car.
Oh, you can really?
So you can get some stereo separation there. But it needs still to be better. I mean, there are technical. But I think if enough of the theaters can switch to digital, they can start sending that digital signal out to the cars a lot better, and you get better sound.
We're going to get calls in a minute, but a couple more questions about New England. Let's just take Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, for example. I don't need a precise number, but of the 357 that still exist, roughly how many do we have in our region?
We have about 15.
15 in those.
And that's not too bad for New England,
You know,
I'm talking New England.
Mm-hmm. We've talked in the show before about Kickstarter, the crowdfunding website, which a lot of people go on to fund their project or they're, you know, actually building some contraption, some watch or something that they want you to fund. How likely is it that something where many, many people, hundreds or thousands of people say, I want drive-ins to live. I want them to continue. I love the Wellfleet drive-in, let's say. How likely is it that something like that is going to be the Superman here that saves some of these drive-ins?
Well, I would hope that that happens a lot, and I think that's what Honda's trying to do with their program. The problem is, as I see it, when I look at the Skowhegan, which is one of the theaters that is doing that, and they've raised $385 in 2 weeks, the process of doing a crowdfunder is incredibly labor-intensive. So that's a real issue, and I don't think that these smaller operators understand the mechanism to make it work. Now, interestingly, on the 23rd of September, the crowdfunding shifts into a new phase where you can now invest in these crowdfunders rather than just doing something along the lines of like getting a T-shirt.
Let's take a couple of calls about your drive-in experiences as best you can tell them on the radio. Let's go to Nathan in Boston with Karen Miller, Jim Browdy, and Garen Daly. Hey, Nathan.
Hey, how's it going?
Excellent. Thanks for the call. What's up?
Well, first, I just want to say I love the show.
Thanks.
But I'm probably one of your younger callers who would have gone to a drive-in theater.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was 18, when I was a senior in high school, every Wednesday, me and my friends would go to the drive-in theater, and we'd just get out all our blankets. You could bring your own food, which is great, because that's where they really kill you at the movie mm-hmm. theaters. And it was just... It was more an experience than it was about the movies.
You know, Nathan, I'm so glad you said that because I thought a minute ago, I lost the thought, and thanks for the call. I'm 6'5" tall. I don't fit in any seats at Fenway. The reason I go to Fenway is for the experience of being at Fenway. And so the reason people go to drive-ins, as Nathan described beautifully, is because of the feel of the thing. There is a certain something that you don't get at the huge screen on your wall in your living room or in a movie theater, right?
Well, and part of that is the community. The yeah. community that you get to see, and you get to meet people, and you go there early, and you're playing frisbee.
It's like a tailgating kind of experience.
It's like a tailgating party, and you bring all your friends, and it's like, it's a gas.
It's an event. It's, yeah. you know, Shakespeare on the Common actually is a lot like that. People bring picnics, and they put them out, and you can kind of see, and you're kind of behind a tree, but it's fun.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly.
Let's go to Paul in Burlington. You're on with Garen Daly. We're talking about drive-ins. Hi, Paul.
I love them. They were the best time of my life. My mom and I used to go in the 35, the 60s. As soon as I got my license, my dates were always at the drive-ins. And I lived in Somerville, and we had two of them. We had the MGM on one side and the Meadow Glen Mall on the other side. And you actually just drove up and down the main roadway there. You could pick which two you're going to see, and they're all four, because you had two shows for, $3. And later on, we had $5 a car loan. And I agree with everybody else about the experience. You brought your own popcorn. You brought your own food. You sat around in your car. And the MGM did have the shows at night. They had it during the wintertime. I mean, they had heaters that you could put in your car, and it's only cost you a couple other bucks. So with that microphone that you got brought in or the speaker that came in, you also had a heater that came in.
Paul, we can hear the smile in your voice through the radio.
Paul sounds ready
That's
to start
call,
the Kickstarter campaign.
Let's try one more. Nick, you're in Peabody. You're on with Garen Daly. Hi, Nick.
Hey, how's it going?
Great.
I was listening, and I used to go to that drive-through in Milford you were talking about
mm-hmm.
before. I went to a private school up in Wilton, and that was the go-to spot for all the kids. I loved it because it was a great chance for all of us to get together, all us underagers, get some alcohol, get some other things that we weren't supposed to be doing. You know, you'd be smoking cigarettes, and after a while, you'd roll up the windows and...
Listen to laughter in this guy's voice. These are incredible. Hey, Nick, thank you for the call. So what's your sense? You talk about this crowdfunding effort. You talk about the Honda campaign. It's 5 years from now. What's the drive-in look like?
I think we're going to lose one-third of the theaters that are out there right now. I think we're going to hold on to about 200 or so. But there's going to be a couple of new trends that are emerging. One is called pop-up drive-ins. And these are drive-ins that are in urban areas. In fact, the Harvard Square Business Association is doing this where they close off Palmer Street and create an outdoor theater going out there.
We have seen just pop-up stores, right, and pop-up restaurants. Right. That's been like a craze over the last couple of years. I've been
idea.
To a couple of them.
And I've been talking with some people who are planning on or in the planning stages of doing a pop-up drive-in series in Boston next summer.
It's going to be like a specialized commodity thing. Yeah.
Well, let me just be clear. We only have 15 seconds left. So what are they projected onto a wall? Do they erect a screen?
There are
for the
inflatable
purpose?
Screens, and you just project it with a Blu-ray DVD player.
I love
That's
that.
That's awesome. I'm going to have the chance yet to go to a drive-in. I'm very excited.
Can you believe
but you won't
have
the concession? The concession is part of the joy.
Okay. Well, I'll go somewhere really overpriced beforehand.
And the hamburgers are terrible.
And you play miniature golf during intermission between the two movies.
And SWAT beat mosquitoes.
Garen, thank you. That's another point we didn't get into. That's a huge problem with drive-ins. Garen Daly is a film critic, director, and producer of the forthcoming documentary, The Orson Welles Project. Garen, it's great to see you.
My pleasure.
Thanks to all of you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, open mic with Charlie Baker. Remember, Charlie Baker said he will announce his decision by Labor Day, right, as to whether or not he is running for governor. Tomorrow's last Tuesday before Labor Day. In the Great Boston Molasses Flood of 1919, and why the adage, slow as molasses, didn't apply. It was a pleasure, Kara.
Thank you very much. It was great being here.
Marjorie Egan will be back tomorrow. I am Jim Browdy. Our show is a production of WGBH.